The first problem in the Philippines is that there's no dairy industry. That is the biggest problem, is that there's no commercial dairy industry here and everything's imported. So the first challenge was me and the guys trying to reach out to cream producers around the world to say, hey, we've got this great idea, but we don't have any cream.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. So I'm going to start this episode with a confession, and the confession is this. I love Baileys Irish Cream Whiskey. Now, for someone who's an occasional wine judge, I probably shouldn't be admitting to that because it's like telling you that I like eating baby food. Baileys is sweet and it's kitschy and I really love it, which is why I was interested to hear about another cream liqueur called Ube. It's made in the Philippines and it comes in a vibrant purple flask. The label on it is covered with what looks like alchemical symbols and it's very attractive, so much so that the six-year-old daughter of a friend of mine swiped the bottle for her bedroom. As for the liqueur itself, it's runnier than Bailey's, so it doesn't sit on top of ice cream quite as well, but it does look way cooler because it's a purple colour, which comes quite naturally from one of the ingredients that's being used. It's also won a bunch of awards and it's found its way into export markets in a fairly rapid time. So I decided to find out more and I met up with Tyson Brance, an Australian who started his career in mining. How he went from that to founding Baraco Distillery in Southeast Asia and then building an export company is quite the story, especially as he's done it from a place that's a distance away from major export markets and in a category that most people would think of as being pretty fusty. It's a fascinating story. Okay, so tell me about your background. I see from LinkedIn that you started in heavy industry and then you moved into founding or co-founding a distillery. How did one thing lead to the other?
Oh, it's a very interesting story. You're correct about my background in electrical, in the mining and oil and gas industry. Yeah, it was an interesting start.
Wow.
Worked in various countries around the world, all over Australia, building and maintaining all types of machinery from the jungles of PNG to the deserts of Oman. Unfortunately, during that period, I actually suffered an injury and damaged my leg and was unable to return to my previous job. And at the time, that was a pretty big deal. I was actually unable to walk for 6 months in and out of hospital, had to look for other career opportunities. And at the time, fortunately, kind of craft distilleries in Australia were just starting to warm up, had some spare time and the need for a new career. Fortunately, at the time, I had a friend called Warren Brewer, perfect name for this industry, who wanted to get out of corporate banking. And he pitched the idea of Capricorn in Rockhampton, invested in that with some other friends, also the head distiller from Baraco in the Philippines, but we'll get to him a little later. I think in that situation, other than having some money and time, the skills that I had were really handy in selecting a lot of the equipment, working with contractors and stuff like that. But we were all brand new at the time and it was a fairly steep learning curve. But somehow with the group that we had there, the first two products we made, we were able to bag a double gold in San Francisco with a product called Billy Goat's Gin. And after 12 months of aging, we created a product called Capricorn Spice Rum that won the world's best spice rum. So
let me just stop you for a second. Sure. So how did you get funding for this? Did you all just put in your own personal money? Did you go to the bank? How did you start it?
It's a great question. And this same story pops up later, but it was really all self-funded. Just a group of investors kind of got together and said, hey, I've got some money. I've got some money too. And let's go. With that company, we tried a few of those gimmicky kind of things with like Kickstarters and videos and stuff like that, but that didn't work out the way we hoped. But we did kind of sell bricks in the distillery and chairs and stuff like that to get a little bit of funding, but that was all mostly self-funded.
You sold bricks in the distillery?
Yeah, you know,
you
like...
You sold bricks? What do you mean you sold
bricks?
Like,
you put your name on the brick here and you get it up in the bar kind of thing, and just little things like that.
Right.
You've got to be creative when you've got no money, that's for sure.
And so going from mining, which I guess is regulated in one area, to alcohol, which is heavily regulated in a different way, what surprised you the most, or what was the most difficult thing?
Yeah, mining, you're right in a sense, because I'm going to apply this two ways, right? Firstly is my electrical background, where electrical equipment in hazardous areas is very, very strict, right? That was the reason why I think my skills were so well suited to this industry, is that I had a background in making sure that the environments were safe. And I think in the craft distillery industry at the time, that was still very early, right? It went from kind of, you're either a massive big distillery or you've just started a craft brand and you had no idea what the regulations were. So I guess in a way that was handy for me on that side. And then obviously my background was very strict as well on rules about where you could work and all types of permits and stuff like that. And I guess early craft distillery days, things were, well, I don't want to say cowboyish, but I guess kind of, you know what I mean? Like,
say cowboyish.
When you've got an emerging market, a lot of people were new to the industry and stuff like that. I guess it could be like America in the early days, right, with craft distilleries.
So selling, did you do it from your own premises or did you try and get distribution through retail?
Okay, so for that, the idea up there was actually that we would buy this really old famous pub and we would basically, it was on the main highway that went through town there. And the idea was that we would renovate this pub, put a rum distillery out the back there and get all the tourists who were driving through town to basically buy bottles of rum, because it's like this main thoroughfare when all the people from Sydney and Melbourne travel up for the winter period. They go up to Queensland in caravans and stuff. So Warren pitched that to me as the original concept. Let's get all these tourists on the way up. We'll convert an old pub. Actually, I just remembered another creative way that we could try and raise money when we pulled all the poker machines out and tried to sell those.
Oh, and did that work?
I don't know. I didn't think we realized at the time that they all have licenses attached to them and things like that. And you literally have to like show the tax department evidence of the machines being destroyed because of, I guess, the nature of that industry.
Right. So did it work? Did you get all of the tourists from Sydney and Melbourne?
Not really, no. We didn't do that. I think the best experience for that particular company is just those awards and kind of the experience we got. And at the time, that was Brendan and I's first foray into that industry. So kind of learned some lessons.
So was it, without giving away too much, was it profitable or was it a learning experience?
Well, that business is still going now to this day, but it's moved to the Gold Coast down there. It kind of had some rebranding and it's right. Moved from Rockhampton down to the Gold Coast, and it's still kind of going fairly well down there. They've got a nice big showroom down there. I think Warren, you know, may have learned in the same way that I did, right? The caravan thing, people driving past didn't necessarily work. So let's move the distillery closer to the people, you know, more potential customers.
Okay. So when did you finish there and move to the Philippines? And what took you to the Philippines?
So I actually did some work on a project in the Philippines back in 2009. And it was kind of like a Mormon temple down in a different kind of island.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, yeah.
Really? What work were you doing for a Mormon temple?
This is the first question everybody normally asks is, are you a Mormon? And
because it's...
And I have to say no.
No, but were you doing the electricals? Were you
exactly.
What were you doing?
Yeah. I just kind of helped a little bit on that project, on the electrical stuff, just trying to, because it was an American company and they were doing something in the Philippines, it was, I guess, fairly complicated in a way that everything had to be built to American standards and stuff. So they just needed some people to kind of get involved and make sure that there was no issues. And that's kind of what took me to the Philippines back 2009. And I guess in a way, the time the Philippines was very different. There was very limited products on the shelves. market was really controlled by a couple of the major companies here. Imported brands were slowly starting to creep into that market, but only the real major stuff. And I think the first trip from the Philippines, it was more of just like me banking that information. And then later on, I kind of became a light bulb moment later on when we decided to sell the shares in the Australian distillery and then also set up the new Baraco Corporation in the Philippines.
Okay, so tell me about that.
This one all started basically, things were coming to an end in Australia. Product One, World's Best Spice Rum. That company managed to get some fairly lucrative contracts for white labeling at the time. But obviously, white labeling is a slightly different business model. You don't own the brand and don't make a lot of the money. So,
can you just explain? We've got a lot of Americans listening. What is white labeling?
So, white labeling is where somebody else comes to you with a concept or a sales channel, and they basically ask you to make the product for them. So, it's very common in the industry now, where a lot of marketing companies are getting involved, and really. What happens is they just do the outsourcing to a lot of, successful, maybe sometimes smaller, sometimes larger brands, and they do all the production and bottling for them, and then you basically plug it into the marketing or the sales channel. Obviously, the margins are a little thinner, but then I guess in a way it kind of removes, which is probably the hardest part of the industry, is actually the selling, and the marketing of a product isn't quite as difficult as the making part, I guess.
Okay, so you were doing that and it sounds like it was less satisfying. So what made you take the leap into the Philippines? Was it that you were looking for a new project? Was it that you saw the opportunity? What was it?
It was opportunity. I guess we took our lessons from Australia, sold our shares in Capricorn, decided that I remember there was an Asian market that was really kind of, I guess, ripe for the pickings. We figured we're closer to Asia, which is one of the biggest targets for a lot of Australian brands, is that, all the wineries and distilleries are like, if I can just crack Asia, or I can crack Singapore, or I can crack China, it's a much better opportunity. Obviously, Australia is a much smaller population than the US or the Philippines or Asia. And I guess in a way that we figured there would be less competition.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, we were actually one of the first craft distilleries in the country.
So who's the we?
The we is myself, Brendan Green, who's the head distiller of Baraco, who came from Capricorn.
Mm-hmm.
And the other we is my wife, Junalyn Allo.
This was not an existing distillery. This was something you found
Correct.
From scratch.
Yeah. We founded it from scratch.
Okay.
And same story again. Basically, from an investor point of view, I don't think setting up a craft distillery in the Philippines is like one of their most ideal investments. Obviously, potentially a lot of risk in a very regulated market that essentially was dominated by a lot of main players. So yeah, again, we had to self-fund the project ourselves and kind of start really, really small so the big competitors wouldn't feel threatened, I guess, by a new competition coming in.
Okay, and what was surprising about the bureaucracy in the Philippines? Were there laws around alcohol or around setting up a business that took you by surprise?
It's a great question. I think a lot of the tax legislation and things are actually derived from the American market. A lot of that was similar, like in terms of like the FDA, like they have an FDA here, which is where you have to register all your products. And in Australia, we didn't have any of that. Australia, the situation is all you have to do is register your brand with the taxation department and you're good to sell. Whereas in the Philippines market here, there was a lot of product registration, product testing and things like that. So I guess in a way, the Philippines was much more strict and regulated when it comes to product, getting a product on the market. We had the FDA have to come out and basically inspect the distillery, making sure that it was compliant. We had none of that in Australia either, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting. Most people would think of America as being a much more dynamic economy, but actually Australia and New Zealand are two of the easiest countries in the world to do
business. Yeah, I'd agree with that for sure.
in terms of being frictionless. And I think Singapore is number one, but the Australia, New Zealand and Singapore are at the top. You can just go and open a business. That's interesting. Okay, so you mentioned the big players. Is that why you launched with the products that you did, that you were looking for niches that the big players weren't involved in? Or how did you decide on the products that you were going to launch? And you should tell us what those products are.
Yeah, you got me there. Obviously, I'm in a market with the number one selling rum brand in the world, the number one selling gin brand in the world, massive brandy production, consumption. So for us, we kind of started out making some gins, high proof stuff, rotovaps, kind of like 43% stuff. And that was quite, there was a section of the market, I think, that needed to be filled for that. And we did fairly well as well. But prior to the big showstopper, which we'll get to, we had a brand called Canto Salted Caramel mm-hmm. Vodka, which was a really good...
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. It's a real direct play on how Filipinos consume alcohol. They have this certain culture where they all like to sit around and tell stories and, you know, just kind of like shot. They call it tagay, where it's basically like, you know, pass a cup around, pour it in, drink it and pass it around and kind of tell another story. So we kind of wanted to create the perfect product for that environment. That was kind of like a really good moment for us because it really started to sell well. And it kind of, we still had no money at this stage, but it kind of created like a cult-like following in the underground, you know, this little product that kind of comes up and everybody drinks it at parties and stuff. So That kind of got us a little bit of a reputation in the market. And then...
Let me just stop you and ask, do you think that product is so culturally specific it will stay in the Philippines? Or do you think that same product could work elsewhere?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question right now that we're trying to figure out. But the products are obviously very targeted by not only the names but also the drinking culture here. And that's one of the things we're trying to figure out at the moment in some of these export markets is... Yes, for the caramel product, there's already so much competition for that. So we don't really think that will penetrate the outside market. But what it does do, and this is a real big business goal for us, is to target's probably not the right word, is be really specific about our export agreements into Filipino populations. So one of the best things about the brand and the opportunity we have is that Filipinos are some of the most transient people in the world. They work all over the world. They work in Dubai, Europe, the USA. There's really easy growth for us and our brand just because we're very, very targeted towards a certain demographic. And the numbers in that demographic are just simply huge.
That's how Italians sold wine into the US, is they targeted Italian restaurants.
Yeah, exactly. Second part of the question, and maybe I should talk about the second product that we do that is very, very popular. Would you like me to go there?
Yes, talk about the second popular product. Go there.
So after the salted caramel vodka, during the pandemic, we were like most businesses, wondering how we were going to survive and needing to be creative. So the goal was for the R&D team during that period was to kind of create 5 new SKUs. And we would see what we came up with. And at the time, the guys, one of my business partners, Kalel Demetrio, who's a very kind of famous mixologist here in the bar industry, he came into the room and presented like a purple creamy drink. And at the time, we really had no idea what this was, but it was very, very tasty. So we had to figure out what it was and how we could turn it into a commercial product at the time. The biggest challenge really for that was the cream section of the product was the big problem, right? Obviously, we had no shortage of ethanol in the country or vodka. We had the facilities to do all of that.
I'll just clarify, you're talking about a cream liqueur. You're getting ready to take on Bailey's with this product.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's the biggest competitor.
Okay, so back to the story. So what's the fundamental problem with making a cream liqueur?
The first problem in the Philippines is that there's no dairy industry.
Oh, right, that is a problem, yes.
That is the biggest problem is that there's no commercial dairy industry here and everything's imported. The first challenge was me and the guys trying to reach out to cream producers around the world to say, hey, we've got this great idea, but we don't have any cream. And obviously at the time, this is kind of somewhere around the middle of the pandemic when the whole shipping industry was kind of broken.
That's right.
I kept going to different suppliers around the world saying, hey, can you send us some cream? We've got this great idea. And they would pass, like America would pass me off to Europe, and then Europe would pass me off somewhere else. In the end, I actually had to convince somebody that they would just send us one drum of this specialty cream product. The only option was to fly it from Europe. We flew a drum of cream from Europe to Asia. And what we were trying to do, I begged them and just said, look, just give me one drum so I can do a proof of concept. We made up the batches. We sent it to the SIP Awards in the USA. It won a Product Innovation Award, double gold medal. And then from there, I took that back to the cream suppliers and said, here you go, there's your proof of concept. All of a sudden, all the suppliers who didn't want to work with us in the past were interested.
Okay. All right. So let's just pull this apart a bit. So I had no idea that you could fly drums of cream around the world. I've learned something. Okay. So what is a specialty cream? What is it that makes it special apart from being cream?
So to get a dairy product, and I've had to become an expert of this in the last couple of years because it's one of the biggest challenges to scaling the product. But to get a cream commercially stable that can give you the shelf life that you need of a product like Bailey's and things like that, it has to be treated and pasteurized a certain way.
Okay.
It's got to be transported a certain way. That's kind of the story to creams.
So with cream liqueurs, how do you stop the cream going? I mean, first of all, what do you do? Is it just a mix of cream and spirit, or like what is it, and how do you keep it shelf stable?
Well, I guess
without giving away trade secrets,
I was going to say I don't want to ruin the whole mystique of the industry.
Give me an idea. Okay, so let me ask a different way. If you were product manager at Bailey's and you had to put together a new cream liqueur, what are the challenges of working with cream?
I think there's a couple of options, right? And a lot of people, again, I don't want to give away too much in the industry, but there's certain companies around the world who can really bring your ideas to life. And there are a lot of them are involved in Europe and the US. So you've got the option of going to one of these major kind of white labeling places, and they can kind of help bring your product to market. Unfortunately for us, we did it the hard way. Basically, just you can also buy like compounded creams that you then have to blend in with your own ethanol and things like that. So there's kind of a couple of ways to do it. But I guess one of the biggest challenges is, like you say, if you don't get the pH right, or there's not enough sugar, or there's too much sugar, or there's too much cream, not enough ethanol, the product really won't be commercially stable for a couple of years' time, or for a couple of years, which is the goal, right? Like once you get into the distribution stage, everybody, first question they ask is, you know, what's the shelf life? So to be able to achieve that, you've got to rely on, like I said, either a main manufacturing partner, or you have to do a lot of independent testing and analysis and things like that. And you have to prove that the commercial stability is good for the 2 years. And that means obviously speeding up the aging process and things like that. So I guess in a way it's a lot more tricky than, you know, just a gin or just a rum or something like that. You know, there's a lot less that could go wrong with that. And the cream stuff really requires, you know, food scientists and all of those things.
So are you making it in the Philippines or are you making it overseas? Where is it being made?
At the start, while it was very small, we were manufacturing everything in the Philippines. And that is still happening for certain markets. For the Australian market, the manufacturing is here. The Philippine market, the manufacturing is here. Thailand, Japan, Hong Kong, anywhere in Southeast Asia, the idea is that we'll manufacture the product in Asia. But we did just start doing manufacturing in Europe for some markets. European market will be manufactured in Europe.
Interesting. That's like beer. You know, a lot of beer is brewed locally. So how do you find, when you've got a drink like this, how do you find partners?
We had to do a lot of trade shows and a lot of Google searching.
Right.
Yeah, like I said at the start, when we just had this crazy concept, no one was interested. I'm not sure if I got to the part where this product won the world's best cream liqueur. That that's really what shone a light on any of the issues that we were having with being able to scale this product. The minute that we won the world's best cream liqueur, the phone didn't stop ringing, and instantly it was thinking about scaling the product.
So would you recommend to other people making drinks that they just put their drinks in for those award programs?
I think for us, because it was a new idea, a new concept, proving that a Filipino craft distillery could actually be at that level, I think the award shows are probably the easiest way to get some sort of recognition or credibility. And then if you somehow jag the big ones, then, yeah, it can give you a lot of attention that you may not have gotten.
So I've got so many questions to ask you, but I'll start with I'll go back to the cream liqueur. So given that this sounds like quite a difficult product to make, it's making me wonder why the category has been so dusty for such a long time. Is it because the barrier to entry is quite high because it's a difficult product to make? Or have you got any views on that? Is this a category that's ready to take off again? Or give me your thoughts.
Great question. Let me first start by saying that when we got into this industry, we were never planning to make cream liqueurs. It wasn't really on our list of things to do. And that could be one of two reasons, like you said there. The barrier of entry could be too difficult for a lot of small producers. Like, they don't have the facilities to do that, or they don't have the in-house testing and things like that. Another thing could be because of Bailey's and some of the other dominant brands in the market. And I guess if you look at the breakdown of revenue just by section in the spirit industry, cream liqueurs is just so small, right? And nobody really says, hey, I'm going to go and dominate the cream liqueur industry, because they perceive the market to be smaller. But I don't know whether it's a combination of those things, but I think there has been, up until recently, hasn't been a great deal of innovation in that section, segment of the market. And I guess for us, not only has that worked in the Philippine market, but because we were the first cream liqueur here, we also have the opportunity to slot into a category there where we don't have a lot of competition. I mean, this is the first ube product in the market, but it's also, you know, the first Filipino cream liqueur. I don't know if that gives us the opportunity.
Yeah, let's talk about the purple color. Let's talk about the ube. So that's a Filipino. Well, tell me about it.
Essentially, ube is a purple yam that's native to the Philippines. It's actually been a cultural staple in the Philippines for over 400 years, and it's used to mark all fiestas, celebrations, and things like that. In a lot of the areas here, when there's a festival, they will make the product into like rice cakes and desserts and things like that. And fortunately for us, no one had ever made it into a cream liqueur. But the minute we did, it seemed so obvious. And I guess it was kind of like a light bulb moment. Yeah, like every Filipino in the world knows what ube is. And they all grew up consuming it in desserts their whole life. At every fiesta. So it's got that connection between the consumers, like the way they celebrate something, ube is always there. So we wanted to create a drink that was perfect for that kind of celebration moment. It's like the perfect storm.
Yeah, this is the perfect time to ask the question. There's a lot of sensitivity at the moment about people going into foreign markets and using their sort of indigenous ingredients or their indigenous stories and so on. Did you think about that aspect of it and how you would tell the story of where it came from?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's very important to not be too risque, I guess. I mean, this is a very conservative country, very religious country, and we're trying to tell local stories, but also try and tell them the right way. I have my wife, who's probably heard about 100 different ideas for pitches and ideas and stuff like that, but we also have some really great Filipino business partners. Like I said, Kalel, the mixologist, and he's kind of like he's the creative spark with some of these ideas, where he basically goes out and kind of forages wild ingredients and things like that. And he does a lot of work with the Department of Industry here. And in some ways, his relationship with the farmers and, his background is mixology. So he's created all these crazy cocktails from foraged ingredients. And he's the one who kind of says, okay, we've got this great product that nobody's using. From that, we try and say, okay, what can we do with this ingredient? And then once we've got a kind of proof of concept with a really unique flavor or a product, then we're like, okay, how do we build a brand around that? Or what's the perfect brand to tell this type of story? There's a couple of Australians involved in this business, but essentially it's a Filipino company. We really rely on them to be able to kind of project what story we need to tell with this ingredient.
Okay, so you're mentioning proof of concept, and previously you mentioned your R&D team. When you develop something, how do you know it's going to work? Do you have a sampling program? Who is your R&D team? How does it work? And have you had lots of ideas that you've thrown away?
We've got lots of ideas that haven't come to the market yet, but we've also got another 9 to 10 SKUs sitting in the pipeline ready to pull the trigger. But some of them, honestly, the biggest hits that we've had have just been literally gut instinct, like no market data, like, oh, this product is going to fit this section of the market. There's, 50,000 consumers for this product. It's not like we went to the market with data and said, okay, we've got to find a product to fit this demographic. The best products that we have are just like creative ideas and gut instinct to take them to the market.
All right. So my next question is export markets. How did you go from the Philippines to all the different markets you're talking about? And so start with your first export sale. How did you get it?
The first export sale was Taiwan. And we got our Taiwanese distributor at Pro Wine in Singapore. So we had a booth over there. And the idea was that we went there to try and get a contract in Singapore. So we went there, and then funnily enough, it got picked up. We didn't get a Singapore distributor at the time, but we did get one for Taiwan. At the time, like, that was our first export deal. That really opened our eyes up to even more paperwork. At the time, we're like, oh yeah, we're ready to export now. and then little did we know that triggered a whole nother round of paperwork and things like that. But in the end, we got there, and from there, the first strategy that we tried for a year was going to spend a whole heap of money at trade shows to try and get distributors. And in a way that worked, but it was a much kind of longer and more expensive way to do it. After we spent that whole year doing it, we got some really good leads for some small distributors around the world. And then after that, and this is only something that came up recently, we hired an old pro in the American market who was involved in the early stages of selling Tequila Rose around the world. He was also involved in the early stages of Patron Tequila before it became a thing. I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name or not. He does a lot of work with different people.
You can say his name.
I'm just more worried about him than anyone else. But essentially, he's got 25 years experience selling spirit around the world. So we kind of hired him about 3 months ago. And then that gave us access to a Rephidex of distributors around the world that we could have probably been spending 10 years of trade shows trying to find. So, yeah.
Okay. So if you were going to advise somebody who was doing a startup, would you tell them to go straight to hiring an expert, or would you say try the trade route first, maybe as proof of concept?
I was going to say we didn't have money to hire somebody at the time, but then I remember how much money we spent on the trade shows. And I guess if you, it's funny because the lead for hiring the expert only came through networking, right? So we had to do a lot of networking to get those leads. And I guess that only came from doing either the trade shows or having a lot of friends in the industry already, which at the time, we were brand new to the industry in Australia. we were then brand new to the industry in the Philippines in that we didn't have any leads. So I guess for us, we had to spend the money doing the trade shows because we didn't have the leads. But if I knew what I know now, I would have just gone and hired the industry expert straight away.
All right. So my next question is, where do you see the big opportunities at the moment now that you've, I mean, one thing about going to trade shows, I find, is that it tells you what the trends are really quickly. You know, you can walk the halls and you can just visually see what's coming, what's going. For you, where are the big opportunities at the moment?
While I'll agree with you that the trade shows are the way to pick up those trends, a lot of the times, by the time somebody else is doing it there, it's almost too late. You know what I mean? That's not to say that you can't, you know, still create an amazing gin or rum or some sort of trend, right? But if somebody else is already doing it or has already done it and it's in the market, they've already kind of got the edge on you, right? Like they've already got an established brand in the market. In some ways, it's too late at that point, but I still think that's the way to do it. But for us, really, the only secret to success was being the first person to do something in a market and kind of having no competition. That's really the what's given us that slingshot moment now, you know.
Can I ask how many cases you produce? How big is the production?
Yeah, so it's all really started to explode in the last 12 months. We just did our first run in Europe for 30,000 bottles. Last year, we did 200,000 bottles. Basically, it's been doubling, at least doubling every 6 months for the last 2 years.
And which markets?
Which markets?
Yes.
Yeah, so the US now got a couple of, or one potentially big deal on the table there with the importer and distributor of some of our more famous friends in the Philippine market. And that has the potential to be nationwide, assuming we get really good sales trends from markets like California and Hawaii. So for us, the first plan is to really take on the Filipino market. Let's get the product in the hands of as many Filipinos as we can.
And how are you planning to contact that market?
Weirdly enough, that market have been contacting us for the last 2 years. Once the pandemic finished, a lot of people haven't traveled or seen family for so long. So what we found was that a lot of Filipinos would come back home to the Philippines and visit family and friends. And what was waiting for them back here when they came was a product called Ube Cream Liqueur that just won the world's best liqueur. So what these people were doing was putting it in their bags and taking it back to the US and Europe. And when they took it back there, because of the way the product is consumed at parties with large groups of people, one person would take a bottle to a party. And then all of a sudden, 20 Filipinos just heard about Ube Cream Liqueur. The first thing they all did was reach out to our social media page and basically say, hey, why can't I buy this in California? Why can't I buy this in Europe? So in a way, it's the perfect storm where because of the product's uniqueness, there's no competition for it. And the way that it's resonated with the market is that a lot of the marketing is being done for us by the consumers. For us, it's not so much of a challenge like, okay, the product's in the market, how do we sell it? It was more, okay, what hurdles do we have to jump through to be able to get this product in the market?
So you've become very, very good at international paperwork.
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is an American podcast, so I'll be a little specific to the market there. Probably the most challenging market in terms of paperwork that we've seen so far around the world is the American market in terms of formula approvals. This is even before you get to the three-tier system. Formula approvals, cola labels, each state has different licensing, so the product's got to be registered in each state. And then once you get to that stage, then you're at the three-tier system. So, yeah, it's quite challenging, but fortunately, after 12 months of hard work, we seem to have got around all of that. And then obviously the next stage was picking importers. And that's where we are right now.
All right. So what's next? Have you got new products on the board or are you going to just put your energies into consolidating and growing what you've got?
Well, I'm kind of like a dreamer. I'm like, okay, let's get the Ube sorted so we can move on to the other nine SKUs we have. But When you have a product doubling in production every 6 months, it becomes a little bit challenging to get all of that sorted, not only from a production standpoint, but also from a financing standpoint. So, the idea is that we'll consolidate what we have at the moment, which is like we just literally opened America, we just opened Europe, the new sales guys got samples into Japan, Hong Kong, Shanghai, which are obviously all really major markets. So I think the idea for this year is to try and just consolidate with that ube, the original ube. We did actually win another award at the world's best gold medal last year with a new version of ube that is coconut.
Oh, okay.
So it has coconut cream instead of dairy cream, which is kind of ironic that would have been probably the product we should have released first, because the Philippines is renowned for coconuts.
Which one do you like? Which one do you personally like better, the coconut cream or the dairy cream?
Depends when this podcast comes out, because if it comes out before coconut, it might hurt sales for the original ube. But no, the original is still good.
I don't think so. The ube is such a strikingly, interesting colour. I poured it for some friends who came over on Friday night, and everybody was kind of entranced by the colour, actually.
I know. Weird thing about the colour, right? This was complete fluke. But if you combine the colours of the Filipino flag, the red, white and blue, it basically turns into purple. And then, like, ube is very hot in the world right now. Purple is a really popular color right now. All of these things weren't planned. They're just complete accidents. But it's kind of ironic how some of these things just kind of fall together like that. But yeah, it's a very interesting product. We feel like, obviously, once we break out of the Filipino segment, we feel like this really works well with bartenders, right? Because everything's about Instagram now, and the better your cocktail looks on Instagram, the more likes you get and the more success you have, right? So we've got if you look online on Instagram now, like ube cocktails or purple cocktails, I mean, they're very striking. For us, that's an easy way to try and grow the brand as well.
So everybody else is doing your social media for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the perfect storm, right? Like, create something that everybody sells for you in a way.
All right. Well, on that optimistic note, I'm going to say thank you so much for your time. I've learned a lot, and I've really appreciated it. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you too. I'm a big fan of your podcast, and I actually got a lot of my secrets from your podcast. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.